Because it seems like a lot of work compared to just buying a stock or an index fund and then leaving it there. So what if you are lazy or it looks like too much work? Is there just no choice? Is it not as bad as us lazy people think? Is there like a shortcut? Well, first of all, taxes. So especially if you take out a loan to buy the property, you then got to put that on your tax. I don't even know how it works, but I know I fill in the tax form
You
for
have an
my.
accountant for that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So I had to
Why
fill
do you
in the
think I know
thingy.
that? Are you kidding me? I just bring them the documents and say deduct everything you can.
Oh, okay. Well, I do mine myself now. And I fill in the bit that says I have the mortgage on my own house that we live in. But then if I get an investment thing, then I'm going to have to go to an accountant because it sounds like it's complex. So it's either extra work or
I
it's
do know
extra
people that do it
money.
themselves, but it depends on how much you like doing this kind of things and how good you are at it. I wouldn't presume to know, and I wouldn't presume to be interested in doing it, to be honest. So
Okay.
I just pass it to an accountant. Hi there, folks, and welcome or welcome back to Nippon Trading International's Japan Real Estate Podcast. I'm your host, Ziv Nakajima again, and this podcast is brought to you, among others, by Emil Gorgis of realestate.jp. He's a Tokyo real estate agent who specializes in serving international or mixed nationality families who are looking for the perfect family home. So Emil's an Australian. He's been living here in Japan for over two decades now. And for about half of that time, he's been buying, selling, and managing real estate properties in Tokyo on behalf of his own family and a great many happy clients. And he also acts as a mortgage broker on behalf of his clients. So he's got dedicated loan officers in many of the Japanese mega banks. And if you're a regular listener of the podcast, you probably already know him from our JREP, the Japan Real Estate Experts panel sessions, which means that you're already aware of the fact that the man is an absolute fountain of wisdom on all things related to real estate in Japan, and in particular to family homes, the greater Tokyo metropolitan area, and mortgages. And most importantly, he's incredibly generous with his time and advice, which he's more than happy to provide at no cost or commitment to anyone asking. So if you've been thinking about buying your home in Tokyo, but you've been sitting on the fence for a while, or you just want to have a chat in English with a real expert, drop him a line on sales@realestate.jp. Hit him up today and start exploring your options. All right, so for today's episode, Retire Japan, which for the three folks among you who are not familiar with them, is Japan's most comprehensive English language resource for those among us who aspire to retire with some kind of financial comfort. They've had a YouTube channel for a while now, appropriately named Retire Japan TV. And they've asked me if I wouldn't mind being interviewed on the channel, which I, of course, immediately agreed to. You may remember Ben Sheeran, or as he's known more widely, Ben Tanaka, who's been a guest on this podcast on several occasions already, and we'll link to one or two of those episodes in this episode show notes. So Ben and his co-host Daniel wanted to talk about a bunch of stuff, starting with my own personal journey, the formation of NTI, who we are, how do our services work, why we're needed, and who it is that needs them most. And then we segued into all sorts of deeper topics, such as Japanese professionals and their approach to foreigners. Are they more open to dealing with non-resident buyers these days? We discussed a very interesting theory that they both had about the sharp difference, in their opinion, between property investors and other types of investors. And then we talked Akiya for a while and abandoned homes, the Akiya craze that's overtaken the world, and how exactly is that manifested in practice? What are the misconceptions that Akiya buyers have, the challenges that they face when they buy and afterwards as they take ownership of these vacant homes? And then how do short-term stay rentals work in Japan? Is it possible to successfully profit from them, and how exactly? How to find information about a property that isn't officially advertised for sale. And then we talked some financing, investment loans. How do they work in Japan? Can I use a property which was purchased using a home loan as a rental or investment property? Accounting, taxes, deductions and claims, tweaking and increasing investment yields, the advantages that draw people to invest in Japanese real estate in the first place, what kind of headaches can landlords expect when they're dealing with Japanese tenants, which investment property profile should we be aiming for, what is the entry point for anyone who wants to be active in the market, what to do if a tenant dies in a property, how would that affect my investment? And finally, a bit about property management. How much do property managers charge? What's the difference between their management services and ours?
How do these services work and how much do we charge for them? And on that front, fair disclosure, the fees that are described in this video have actually increased a bit since we recorded it. So please contact us for an update if you're interested in potentially hiring us. And then finally, we went a bit macro and discussed how Japan's population decline trend actually affects property investment. And lastly, what should someone who has something like 150 or 200,000 US dollars invest in? So really good kind of 101, but deep level overview of Japan's property investment market and the Akiya craze for those of us taking our first steps here. Hope you enjoy the episode and I'll see you again on the other side.
All right. I think we're live. Welcome to Retire Japan TV, where we talk about money and investing and retirement and life in Japan. And today we're joined by the legendary Ziv Nakajima Magen, who is an old friend of Retire Japan. And it feels like he's been on before, but he hasn't been on Retire Japan TV before. He has got a really cool kind of seminar video from way back in the day that he did for us on investing in real estate in Japan. And that's what we want to talk to him about today, once we've got through the initial pleasantries. Hi, Ziv.
Hello. Good to be back.
Thanks for joining us tonight.
When I've only been in Retire Japan channels once to date, but you've been on our channel, the Japan Real Estate Podcast, a bunch of times, right?
Yes. Yeah, it was well overdue to get you back over here. So could you give us your elevator pitch for how you ended up in Japan with the rest of us?
Sure. I kind of, like a lot of us, I guess, married into the country almost 20 years ago now, but married into the country and then quickly grabbed my wife at the time to come and live in Australia.
Ah.
Actually, I met her in Australia, came to visit Japan with her a few times, but we stayed there. And then sadly, 8 years into our marriage, she passed away of a very sudden and aggressive cancer. And I was left there with a half Japanese child. And I really wanted to keep the connection to Japan alive somehow. Best way that I could think of was to first grab a financial foothold in the country, which is how I started looking into investing in Japan, still while living in Australia at the time, and met my business partner, who a couple of years later became my current wife. And after we've started investing ourselves, and real estate was the only thing that I had any kind of inkling or background in, and not that deep of a background, but I mean, more than nothing. So that's what we did. We invested in real estate, and then going through the motions of getting our first real estate investments, we kind of figured out that there's a, you know, more than a few people out there who could use help with all the challenges that come with operating in Japan as a non-Japanese. And and that's how Nippon Tradings International, NTI, was born. And that's what we've been doing for people for the last 12 years.
Yeah. And your online presence is really getting a lot stronger recently. I get the feeling you're on YouTube a lot. I'm seeing your videos all the time, podcasts, interviews with people. It's really very interesting.
Thank you. Yeah, it started with articles, which used to be my forte. And then I found out that I'm pretty good at talking to a microphone, not so much to a camera. Like, I'm really good with a camera if I can talk to people like we're doing now, but just me staring at the camera and talking, I'm not very good at. But I did end up just turning the camera on whenever I record the podcast, and eventually that turned into a YouTube channel as well.
Awesome. So tonight we mainly want to talk to you about real estate, because both Daniel and I are really skeptical about real estate as an investment. We're not real estate people. I have a pet theory that there's kind of real estate people and there's non-real estate people, and you're either one or the other.
We can unpack that.
You're either naturally suited to it and attracted to it, or you're completely not. So where would you stand on that? Would you agree?
No, actually.
I find you're going to convert us on air. This would be cool. Yeah.
This is just going off my... So I'm definitely a real estate person, not for lack of interest in other types of investments. I'm just a firm believer in, you know, invest in what you know and maybe experiment with other stuff that you're not that familiar with in very small amounts and portions, but basically find your 80%, whatever that is. For me, that happens to be real estate because, again, I sort of found myself in it by inheriting a property and then becoming a landlord and then selling it and doing other stuff with it. So I rolled into it, but I can tell you from our customers, for example, which are usually my best point of reference, is that almost all of them are diversified. So they have real estate holdings for sure, sometimes in their country of origin, sometimes in a few places around the world. But almost all of them actually have other types of investments, whether they are running a business or remotely running a business. I mean, sort of passively running a business, investing in a business, let's call it. A lot of equity markets, a lot of people recently are also invested in crypto and NFTs. And actually, we get a lot of people who contact us saying, okay, this is going to be my first ever real estate investments. I've only got stocks and index funds and this and this and that. So no, I don't agree.
Okay, nice, yeah. Nice. So where are most of your customers from? Are they mostly outside Japan or do you have a balance?
Yeah, about 80% of them, I'd say, are out of Japan. Those are the people who most need our help because being out of Japan is just very, very challenging to invest in the country. Even if you do speak the language, or in the case of our customers, I'd say, I don't know, 5-10% of them are even Japanese ancestry people who do speak, read and write and look Japanese and have a Japanese name. But being out of the country without the ability to open a bank account or have a physical address or a phone number that, you know, is still very much required, but a lot of third parties here in Japan. So they're the people who need our help the most. 20% of them live in Japan, but just rely on either our expertise or our language skills, which is not to say my language skills, that's the Japanese side of the business, or just don't have the mental bandwidth or the time or the inclination to deal with it themselves. The ones who live out of Japan, I'd say about half of them are from Australia and Singapore. Those are our two strongest clientele markets. Another 20-30% from the US and the rest everywhere. Canada, Europe, New Zealand, lots of places in Asia. No one from Africa. We do have one from the United Arab Emirates. I think that's officially Africa, but no one from Antarctica yet. So that's our next
one. Right. You're missing that
one. A penguin or a scientist or something. Yeah.
Cool. So how difficult would it be to do this as a DIY project? So not going through an agent, just, you know, waking up one day and thinking, hey, I'm going to buy an apartment or a mansion and get started.
Well, firstly, you definitely, in the vast majority of cases, you would need to go through an agent. We're not agents, by the way, just for clarity and disclosure. We're not real estate agents. So we're a proxy of the buyer. We represent the buyer as if they lived in Japan, or even if they live in Japan, as if they spoke the language and had the local expertise. And we do everything on their behalf in front of all the third parties involved. So realtors, okay. Property
managers. So you would contract an estate agent to buy the property and then maybe a rental agency
property manager
to manage it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And be in touch with, in case of a mansion, a condo unit, we'd be the ones in contact with the building management company, the owner union, insurance company, renovation companies, what have you. We're like the buyer's arms and legs kind of thing.
Gotcha. Okay. So how difficult would it be to do that by yourself? So
if you're living in Japan, and definitely if you're speaking, reading, writing the language, but to a serious degree, because you're dealing with contacts and a lot of keigo, and real estate industry is still very old school in Japan. Everyone's mannerisms are very much by the book in the vast majority of cases. If you're on top of that, then you should be able to handle. I mean, there'd still be, I guess, I don't know, 10-20% of the realtors and sellers that just wouldn't want to deal with you because of the fear of potential misunderstandings or the fear of gaijins or whatever you want to call it.
We've had that, trying to rent properties for my wife's business and things. We've
rent is a whole different.
To our face, just like, nope, we're not going to talk to you today. I was like, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Selling, buying is a bit easier in that regard. Essentially, both the agent and the seller are going to walk away after the deal. So as opposed to a rental agent who has to deal with you throughout the tenancy,
right?
A realtor and the seller, in most cases, are going to be walking away after the deal. So the only concern that they have is you coming back to say, no, that wasn't explained to me correctly. And then problems might occur. But if you are here and you've got, again, the logistics required to handle the purchase and you are familiar and fairly fluent in Japanese, probably not a big deal. But it is a very different market to what many people are used to overseas. So if it's your first purchase in Japan, a lot of things are a bit different to what you're used to from your country of origin, both market fundamentals and the actual logistics of how things work during and after the purchase. So it is handy, which is, again, 20% of our customers are finding it, you know, of value to have somebody who's professional and experienced and 100% on their side. That's another thing. The in Japan, there's this concept of the buyer side agent and the seller side agent, supposedly representing the buyer and the seller. But really, in the vast majority of cases, realtors are realtors. They're transactional focused. They're not gonna, even a buyer side agent would not guide you in what questions to ask or point out some things that might, you know, you might want to consider. Or so it is good to have somebody either as a consultant or fully representing you on your side. And awesome. If you're out of the country, we've seen that change. That's probably some of the things you wanted to discuss. But we have seen that, especially in the last 4 or 5 years, change a bit in the sense that with internet translation capacities increasing over time, gaijins are definitely very comfortable going on Japanese property websites and, to the best of their understanding, searching for listings and trying to contact agents and emailing them with the help of translation apps and whatnot. So I'm guessing, I'm not sure exactly how that happened, but I'm guessing that realtors were being hit more and more and more and more by these foreigner inquiries, to the point where a lot of them are trying, right? So they do their best. They, you know, they hop onto Google Translate themselves and they try to understand what the gaijin is asking, and they're trying to reply with the help again of a translation app. So what we're seeing these days, if in the past we were mainly contacted by gaijins who were hitting a wall because everybody was ghosting them and nobody was replying to their inquiries, now a lot of the time we're contacted by Japanese agents who are saying, hey, there's this foreigner and he wants
help
to buy
us
this
with
property.
Our customers. Nice.
We exchanged 4 or 5 emails, but I don't know what he's asking me now. So please help. Or how do you, we can't receive or send funds overseas, and we don't have any documentation in English, and we're not allowed to, you know, get them to sign documents that they don't understand in Japanese. So help, please. So we do, it's changing. It's definitely changing very slowly, but there's more openness to dealing with foreigners these days, I think, at least compared to 4 or 5 years ago, and definitely compared to when we started.
Wow. Nice.
We interrupt this broadcast to tell you about Tokyo Family Stays. They're a short-term rentals company in Tokyo, and they offer a home away from home experience, which is just perfect for remote working, quarantining, if that's still a thing, or if you just need somewhere quiet to get away from the world. They offer a variety of options for families, corporate relocations, or even if you're simply transitioning between homes in Tokyo. The properties are super comfortable, tastefully furnished, fully equipped with all amenities, and they accommodate up to 10 people. So really the only thing you'll need to bring with you is your toothbrush and maybe a change of clothes. They come with fast, unlimited wireless internet, dedicated workspaces, and fully equipped kitchens. And they're just a delight to stay in, fantastic alternative to Japanese business hotels, which if you've ever stayed in one, you probably know they're tiny, they're noisy, fine for a night or two if you're on your own, but longer term or with a family, you'll probably feel you're in a jail cell very quickly in a Japanese business hotel. So if you want to give yourself a sense of space and freedom by renting a real home with comfortable Western beds, including all the necessities like baby bedding, children's toys, high chairs, etc., you definitely want to reach out to Tokyo Family Stays. They've been at it for over a decade. They're a fully licensed minpaku or short-term stay operator. And as a special bonus for our viewers and listeners, they're also throwing in a breakfast basket upon arrival for anyone who books and mentions the Japan Real Estate Podcast or NTI. And not only for guests, if you're a property owner, you've got an investment property that you want to tweak for higher profit, or a holiday home that you want to rent out when you're not using it via short-term stays, drop them a line today, see how they can help you maximize your property's income. And again, as a special bonus to our viewers and listeners, they're also offering a free audit of your existing short-term stay listings without any obligation whatsoever. So feel free to reach out to them at tokyofamilystays.com. Well worth a visit. And again, if you're in the market for a family home in or around the Tokyo metropolitan area, Emil's your man. Don't be shy to reach out to him as well at sales@realestate.jp. And now back to the podcast.
So I'm seeing people talking about Akiya everywhere recently.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, it's in the news and newspapers, on TV. There's all sorts of people making YouTube shorts about it. Like, check out this Akiya that I'm looking at today, kind of thing. So yeah. Is that a fad? Is this like a serious thing, or does it, what's your take on that?
It's a very complex market. So I don't know if I'd call it a fad, but it's definitely a trend. So people are definitely getting into Akiya. What we normally tell people that contact us, and we do a lot of Akiyas on behalf of people, but the main thing that people really need to understand, and a lot of them unfortunately don't, is that Akiya is a hands-on project, right? You're not going to be buying remotely something that's move-in ready for $20,000 and then come to Japan and live in it. That's just not going to happen. Even less so if the plan, which I'd say at least half, probably a lot more than that, of our customers are imagining that they'll buy an Akiya and not only will they stay there and use it, firstly, it's going to be move-in ready. And once they've moved in and, you know, put everything that they want in it, they'll also be able to rent it out on Airbnb whenever they're not using it for the rest of the year. That's not doable. I mean, I shouldn't say it's not doable, but it's a lot more complicated than what people think it is. The cheap houses that are being continuously advertised on these clickbait articles on international media channels of $5,000 for a house, $500 for a house, $1 a house in countryside Japan. They exist, but those are basically shacks in the woods. They're not going to be livable. They're not going to be on any city infrastructures. It'll have a kumitori, which is like the prelude to septic tanks. It's basically just a huge waste collection tank under the house that smells exactly like it sounds. And, you know, you're going to be maybe on well water, not on city water. You'll constantly need to do water checks to check the quality of your water. And the house itself is going to be very dilapidated to the point where it's going to cost you multiples of the price of the house just to bring it up to livable status, right?
Right.
Once you get over all of these hurdles, which could end up being a lot more expensive than you just buying a real move-in ready house for, I don't know, 8 million yen or 10 million yen, whatever the case may be, renting it out short-term while you're not there is a whole different kettle of fish that you need to wrap your head around, with research of local municipality regulations and the existence of licensed management companies in the area. Because Minpaku, what people are often not aware of if they're not living in Japan, is that the legislation regarding short-term stays was hugely revamped here since mid-2018. And we can get into that in detail if people want, but it's essentially very, very challenging. The licensed management company in place, if it's a condo building, you simply will not be able to rent out short-term stay whatsoever. If you own the entire structure, it depends on what the local municipality says, and they're often going to be a lot more strict than the national regulation. So there's a big national framework of what you're allowed or not allowed to do as far as short-term stays are concerned. And then each local municipality has the right to further restrict it, which a lot of them, if not most of them, do.
And so, then the buildings do it as well, right? So there's layers upon layers of rules. So.
Correct. With buildings, they've actually made it even more simple and more restrictive. It's basically, if the owner union has not specifically written in the regulations rulebook that they are allowing short-term stays and referring to it specifically, then by default, it's banned. Legally banned, not just like because they don't want it. It's just legally banned. So 99.9% of them would never, ever open that option up to unit owners. So in condos,
yeah, ours had posters up initially when Minpaku started getting popular. They're like, yeah, absolutely not.
Yeah.
And we haven't seen the posters. I guess it's now illegal. So nice. So yeah, I mean, Akiya, I almost bought an Akiya. Just
for
outside
people living in Japan, it's not a bad idea. If you're the DIY type and you've got the time on your hands and you take it on as a passion project, then those are the videos that you see. There are people doing wonderful things with Akiya, but it's very, very hands-on.
Yeah, for us, it would have been a weekend. It's a little farmhouse about 45 minutes away from where we live. But yeah. Someone else bought it that morning. It was quite a good deal. It's like a I think it was 1 million yen for a big plot of land, you know, a couple of thousand square meters. So
the land is great. Another thing that people are not necessarily aware of is that the bigger the structure, I mean, land is a different story, but the bigger the structure is, the more it's going to cost you in constant maintenance and renovations and repairs, right? You're not talking in many, like the kominka that you see out in the countryside. If you're not talking about the typical Japanese-sized house, which would be, like, what, 100, 120 square meters, you're talking about these sprawling farmhouses of 300-400 meters. That's a lot of annual expenses that you need to put up with.
Yeah, plus, like, no insulation. It's going to be really cold and really hot. Yeah. And cool. So you're talking about minpaku there. So there seemed to be a kind of Airbnb minpaku boom a while ago. Is that over? I mean, has it been legislated out of attractiveness or?
No. It's definitely not over, but it's very highly regulated at the moment. The 2018 revamp of the legislation was a double-edged sword in the sense that it ruled out casual minpaku for a lot of people just by introducing the need for a license management company and all of the rules that you need to follow with the shuyakusho, with the local municipality of reporting and complying with fire and safety. But it did have the added benefit, which it was touted on as being based on, of just, you know, all the cowboy and Indian stuff that was happening with minpaku was pretty much phased out. And these days, if you stuff up, you lose your license. So people do have to make it safe for guests, and they do have to make sure that people are aware of what they can and they cannot do in a residential neighborhood. And Airbnb is very much alive and well, but you need to be a practitioner. You can't just do... I mean, if you're living in the property and renting out rooms in minpaku, it's still very much doable in most cases. Yeah. But if you just want to buy a house and try to list it on Airbnb and rent it out and, you know, come visit once a week and see that no one's dead, that's going to be a lot more challenging now.
Okay. So it's become more professional and therefore, I guess, guests might trust it more now.
Correct. In one way. And I mean, the cynical among us would say that it was a lot of pressure from the hotel lobby to make it so that it's going to be higher barrier to entry and people would have to charge more, so it's not as competitive as it used to be. And you're really not seeing a lot of these 2,000 yen a night places on Airbnb anymore. But it's still very much alive and well, and people who do it well are making good money. But again, it's a full-time job. It's not a hands-off passive investment like a residential long-term lease.
Okay. And hotels are like 50,000 yen a night now. So. Yeah. Daniel, go ahead.
The Japan Real Estate Conference I attended, there was a lady who did a talk about Airbnb in Japan. And she was saying, really, really good talk. And she was explaining how you've got to love it. And so she clearly does. And she was enjoying it because, like, financial benefits aside, she's engaging with the community. She's helping people come and stay in the community that she knows all the people in. And so she's kind of, in effect, is joining people together. And then, interestingly, she also said she was able to get referral income from restaurant owners or whatever that she gets on well with, and she can guide visitors to there. So it's, much more than just buying a place, sticking it on Airbnb, and you're done. It was really, as you say, it's like really involved. But she loved that side of it. I think if you don't love that, then it's not.
Absolutely. I mean, being a minpaku host is a science, right? It's an art and a science. You have to, and Tracy's an expert at that, you have to cater to a specific type of guest that's not maybe not being served as well by the generic places that are on the market. You have to, again, supplement your income with all of these referrals and extra services that you can charge a commission on as well, right? Like if you organize a babysitter for the guest, the babysitter gets paid, but so do you. And so on and so forth. Organize tours, airport transit, whatever the case may be. It's a business. You're basically running a business, and if you're good at it, you can make good money, but you do need to be constantly tweaking and just, you know, checking vacancy rates and occupancy rates and how much is the competition charging at various seasons. And it's a business, but if you do it well, you can make good money off it.
Nice. Before we go on, can we go to some questions? Clear out the chat, as it were. So I think the first question is from Kelly. So can you see that, Ziv?
I can, but I'll need to maximize the screen to actually read it. Yes. Did you want me to read that?
Basically, how do we find out if the house is for sale, the empty house that we want to buy?
Yeah, so by saying that, Kelly was saying, we did some research and found out the name of the owner. I assume that was by visiting the Legal Affairs Bureau and pulling out the registration documents, which is where the name of the owner would appear. What normally happens next is, since there's usually no contact numbers, the best you can do, I wouldn't go knocking on their door because that's a strict no-no in Japan, but you just send letters, right? You simply send a registered letter, which also gives you the ability to check whether that was received or not. And best you can hope for is a reply. You put your phone number on it, preferably have a Japanese person answering the phone on the other end so that they're not freaked out, and have the letter come from a Japanese entity as well, because again, you're dealing with very traditional owners in many cases, and just try your luck. There's not really much else that you can do beyond that, I think.
Okay.
I mean, questioning the neighbors is not a bad idea. Sometimes if the neighbors are friendly, they'll tell you that what's his name moved to that and that prefecture, or they're living across the street, or their kid, they passed away and the kids are over there. You might get a phone number, because sometimes they leave their emergency contact number with one of the neighbors. But that's really about it.
We had a similar thing, actually, when we were renting just one block away. There was an empty house, which was kind of nice, and we wondered if it would be for sale. And so I wasn't quite brave enough to write a letter, but they clearly, every now and then, the grass would be cut. So I was, okay, somebody is coming here occasionally cutting it. And
catch the gardener as they're walking in.
Yeah, well, I think it was the sun or something like that. But yeah, one time I caught the guy outside cutting and said, oh, you know, the house is not being used. You know, do you think it might be up for sale sometime? And he's a clear no. But
okay,
that was one alternative of getting an answer.
Okay. Right, our next specific question. I don't actually understand what this means, so hopefully you do, Ziv.
Yep. Can we talk about debt recycling, either buying property with equity loans or stock is possible in Japan? So by stock, I'm assuming the reference is to property stock, not stock market stock. I'm not sure. But in any case, drawing on your equity is not a thing in Japan. So your borrowing capacity here is assessed purely by your income. And you can borrow. We're not mortgage experts. Most of our buyers are cash buyers. But according to people who do know, like Emil, who's on our podcast regularly, you can borrow up to 7 times your annual salary, roughly, depending on the lender, depending on what debt you might have or not. And when you've paid off some of that debt, then you can borrow again. So if your salary is increased over time, you'll be able to borrow more. But there's no collateral. The fact that you have assets that have equity in them will not give you further borrowing capacity. No. It does. As
someone with no income and some assets, that's very disappointing.
No. And the income has to be in Japan as well. A business loan is a bit different. So if you're borrowing, if you're asking for an investment loan on behalf of a business, then they'll assess other things, but it's still not going to be related to assets. It's going to be related to perhaps what your rental yield is going to be, and will that be enough to pay for the loan? So they would factor in income that you would potentially get from the property by renting it out as part of your income stream that enables you to borrow, but not on equity itself, unfortunately, in Japan. Some would say that that's actually a boon, because that avoids inflation and speculation. But whether that's going to change, I don't think so. That's probably going to be the case as far as the eye can see.
Well, affordable housing in Japan is wonderful, I think. Coming from the UK, where housing is not affordable, and all the social problems that come from that, I'm a big fan of Japan's property market.
You're clearly not referring to Tokyo, right?
No. But even Tokyo, I mean, compare Tokyo to Sydney or London.
Oh,
or
yeah, no, absolutely. Canada, but I mean, compared to the rest of Japan, it's a bit...
Yeah. Now, here's some big news for anyone interested in Akiya, the abandoned vacant homes that are abundant all around Japan for very attractive purchase prices. Akia Mart, our latest sponsor, is a recently founded online search and discovery tool for Japanese real estate. Its user interface will be very familiar to users of Zillow or Redfin. The platform essentially scouts the internet for property listings, translates them into English, and displays prices in US dollars, all in one place and with a dynamic map interface that makes browsing, finding, and shortlisting your favorite properties a piece of cake. Which any of you have been struggling with the dozens, if not hundreds, of Japanese property websites that are available online and their very clunky interface will probably find a real blessing. They've got already over 500,000 listings on the platform, and the database is expanding daily. Ranging from abandoned rural homes to luxury urban properties, Akia Mart makes it easy to find your dream home in Japan, regardless of your budget. Now, while the platform is essentially free for use, here's an exclusive offer for listeners of the podcast. You can use the promo code NTI to receive $5 off Akia Mart Pro. The subscription will unlock a bunch of very attractive features for you, including unrestricted access to the entire nationwide property database and a whole range of filters, which will help power charge your search for that elusive perfect home and make it even easier. So hop over to akia-mart.com. That's A-K-I-Y-A-M-A-R-T, akia-mart.com, and kick off your search today.
Yeah.
Right, we've got one more, which I think I know the answer to, but I'm going to let Ziv answer it.
Yeah, thinking to move to Australia, can I still own the current house and rent it out as an investment property if I move outside Japan? So I'm assuming the question is related to a house that's borrowed on. So you're paying off a mortgage, a jutaku loan, a house mortgage, a residential home loan. Officially, not. And I wouldn't say that you don't have to tell the bank, but assuming that the bank finds out, or either by you telling them in advance or by them just finding out themselves, that you've moved to Australia, depending on the lender, how strict they are and how familiar they are with you and your history with them, you could potentially tell them that you're moving on a work assignment for a number of years, and naturally you're going to be coming back and living it again, but you don't want it standing empty in your absence. Some of them will take well to it. Others will just say, no, you have to refinance it as an investment loan, or in a worst case scenario, you have to pay it off, right?
Okay. What's the worst case scenario if you did rent it out without saying anything and then they found out?
They could potentially ask you to repay it off immediately. Oh, so okay. You'd essentially be forced to sell it and pay off the loan.
Right.
Great. I think that more or less gets through. We've got a couple of other ones.
There was one general one about the cost of owning a house, the taxes and fees and things like that. But maybe we'll get onto that, I think, in a minute.
Okay. So, Daniel, you had the very technical question, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. So as Ben mentioned at the beginning, neither of us are in property investment at the moment. I think I might be a bit warmer than Ben, and I keep coming back to it. I watch the UK property TV shows. It's like, oh, that looks like a really good idea. And then I sort of analyze the Japan market, and I've actually been in touch with one of your staff, and they sent me a sort of model breakdown on a spreadsheet, which is very good, but I've never quite been able to make the final step. Mm-hmm. And so because it seems like a lot of work compared to just buying a stock or an index fund and then leaving it there. So what if you are lazy or it looks like too much work? Is there just no choice? Is it not as bad as us lazy people think? Is there like a shortcut?
Well, to understand that, clarify for me what you mean by a lot of work.
Well, first of all, taxes. So if you take out a loan to buy the property, you then got to put that on your tax. I don't even know how it works, but I know I fill in the tax form.
You have an accountant for that kind of thing.
Right. Yeah. So I had to fill in.
I know that. Are you kidding me? I just bring them the documents and say, deduct everything you can.
Okay. Well, I do mine myself now. And I fill in the bit that says I have the mortgage on my own house that we live in. But then if I get an investment thing, then I'm going to have to go to an accountant because it sounds like it's complex. So it's either extra work or
I do know people that do it themselves, but it depends on how much you like doing this kind of things and how good you are at it. I wouldn't presume to know, and I wouldn't presume to be interested in doing it, to be honest. So I just pass it to an accountant. Accountants in Japan, I mean, you'd have a salary or other income sources, so it would be a bit different. I'm assuming probably a bit more pricey. But for our customers, for example, who don't live in Japan and have no income except their Japanese rental property income, it's like 1,000 yen per person a year for tax filing. It's not exactly going to break the bank.
And you can deduct it, right? It's an expense of having property.
Everything is an expense. Well, there's a lot of people who are buying, especially people with higher incomes, that are buying properties for all of those deductions, because then it reduces their taxable income, because they're so when you buy a property, you claim all of your purchase costs for the first 3 years. And then every year you're claiming all of your management costs and the depreciation of the property. And if it's relatively new, then you have more depreciation to claim. That all can actually reduce your taxable income so that you're paying less taxes. So again, over my pay grade, but accountants can do wonders with that.
Right. This is where I feel like it becomes hard work in terms of working out whether it is worth it, because you've got all that stuff there and the potential deductions for this. And then you've got money coming in from that, but then you've got money going out in terms of the annual upkeep and potential maintenance. And then trying to work out overall, okay, so is it worth it or is it not worth it? There's lots of variables there you have to sort of calculate.
Well, I'd first look at it from a purely yield perspective. Can you get the 4, 5, 6% that you'll get on your property rental income in, you know, taxable income? So net pre-tax income from a good location, good quality Japanese property, at the best of cases will be about 4, 5, 6% a year. Mm-hmm. If you've got other avenues that can generate the same sort of taxable income and you're not too concerned about diversity or you're diversified in other ways, then probably not, right?
Right. So it's the diversification thing that is a big thing that personally I've been neglecting, actually.
Then do bear in mind that there are a lot more deductibles with a property compared to other types of investments. So if you're getting borderline to the point where, I could get something that's maybe 4, 5, 6% elsewhere, but I'm being taxed a lot as is with my current income, then yes, that does definitely become a profitable endeavor. But unless you're really an accounting geek, I wouldn't try to do it yourself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, one thing about real estate property income in Japan is that you can use it to offset your employment income. And most of your side gigs and things, like if you have miscellaneous income, you're not allowed to apply that to your employment income. So that's the huge
When you say apply the income to the income, you mean apply the expenses to the income?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any relevant expenses from real estate, you can take off your employment income. But say something like Retired Japan, which is a side kind of miscellaneous thing, I can only apply expenses to the Retired Japan income.
Right.
Not to employment income. So that's why property is attractive to some people.
Property income is and expenses are factored into your general income stream. Yes.
And then comparing property in Japan to property in other like booming Western countries. So I think Canada is in a bubble, or it wasn't a bubble recently. And I'm from the UK. UK's often always seems to be in a property bubble. You get these people who flip houses by improving it to sell, or they'll improve a house to increase the rental yield. But it feels like in Japan, the rental yield is much more based around location and age of the property, and not so much about whether you've put in new windows or nice taps or something. Is there anything you can do as a homeowner to increase the value or increase the yield? Or is it not?
So that's mainly correct. The ones that do make a buck on flipping properties or improving them and then getting a higher rental income are usually companies that are very professional at doing that. They've got the contractors in place to do the renovations very, very cheaply. They go to foreclosures and get the properties very, very cheaply and then renovate them very cheaply. And then they definitely can sell them at a profit. And similarly, they can rent out a property that just wouldn't have been rentable before, right? So they buy it, Akiyas, but in locations that are a bit more attractive that they can cheaply renovate, or foreclosed properties that they can renovate. They can buy a cat in the bag. They don't care because they know that it's not going to cost them beyond yay much to then renovate it to livable standards. For the average salaryman or otherwise employed person who wants to do it as a hobby project, strip gut a property, renovate it yourself. If you're the DIY type, maybe. if you're going to be relying on contractors that you as an individual who's not connected in the industries and not experienced with them with the network in place, then it's not a very profitable deal. No. The people that invest in Japan, again, referring to our clientele, which are my best litmus test, are drawn here, number one, because of the affordability. So for the same budget or capital that you're going to be investing, you can get 3, 4, 5 properties as opposed to the one overseas, which gives you diversified income stream, diversified socioeconomic profiles of tenants, diversified geographical locations all over Japan. For the hassle-free nature of the tenants and the professional companies that you're working with. So Japanese tenants are very docile. It's very rare that they have payment issues or, I mean, squatting and forced evictions, though they are very much unheard of in Japan in a very, very low percentage of the cases. We've never had to force evict a single tenant. And really, if on the rare occasion we did have somebody chronically delayed or not paying, then we send them a letter and off they go kind of thing, right? It's not a
very civilized.
Yes. And the companies that you work with as well, I mean, property managers, insurance companies, owner associations, nobody has their hand in their pocket looking for the opportunity to hit you with a penalty or a late fee or grab extra fees that they haven't even mentioned in the fine print. It just doesn't happen here. Everything is very headache-free. We have different types of headaches. You know, people die in the property because they're elderly and they pass away and, you know, 70, 80 year old men who never opened the window and smoke like a chimney for 20 years inside the room or whatever the case. But you don't have the kind of dramas that you have in a lot of countries overseas, especially if you're referring to the USA and the UK. Payment issues are non-existent and everything is very headache free. And the third thing is that compared to other locations in, I don't want to say the first world, it's not really a first, second, third world anymore, but let's say compared to most other Western or Westernized countries, the cash flow is pretty high, right? If you look at Singapore, Australia, prominent locations in most countries in Europe and the US and Canada, definitely, Hong Kong, Singapore, you'd get 3%, you'd be very happy. Here we can still get 4, 5, 6%. Not the 10, 11, 12 that we got when we started 12 years ago, but still relatively high compared to other countries.
Mm.
You're making it sound much more tempting, actually. I might change my mind. Maybe I should do it as an experiment, a retired Japan experiment.
Right. We get a YouTube series out of it.
Yeah. We normally tell our customers to... we tell them this in the context of a property portfolio, but I think it applies to any kind of investment, is do your main thing. Again, do your 80% that you know and are comfortable with and that's generating a stable and safe and steady, or even if not stable, safe and steady, just something that you understand and are comfortable dealing in. And then get adventurous with, I don't know, depending on your risk appetite, 10, 20% of your portfolio. Buy something for, I don't know, 40, 50,000 and see how it does while your 400, 500,000 is sitting in stuff that you understand better. Right?
So what's the kind of price range for these things? What's the buy-in? You know, if you want to buy one property that's cheap, what would that look like in Japan?
Entry level for a reasonable quality long-term rental residential property in Japan, I'd say it would start at around 4 million yen. They're not going to be the best properties in the world. They're going to be satellite cities, like somewhere bedroom communities within an hour from a major metropolitan center, or they're going to be prefectural capitals, like the biggest city in whatever prefecture it is. Obviously not the top 7 metropolitan centers in Japan, but could potentially be quite close to them. 25 or 20 to 30-year-old building. Studio or one bedroom unit, these would start at around 4 million yen. To get better quality properties, better quality tenants, I'd aim towards 8 million yen as a starting point.
Is the yield different? So the cheaper ones have a lower yield or a higher yield?
No, the cheaper ones tend to have higher yield on purchase, but that yield is not going to be nearly as stable. If you buy something a lot younger, let's say family-sized property as opposed to a single or couple-sized property in a better location in a newer building, then you'd start with lower yield, but it would hold on. It would hold over time a lot better. When you're buying into the higher yields, cheaper properties, they tend to fluctuate a lot more. Because of their age and the types of tenants that you're going to be getting, you're going to have more frequent tenant changeovers, which whenever that happens, that comes with, I don't know, 2-3, depending on location, up to, let's say, 4 months of vacancy. And more frequent, small, not expensive, but more frequent renovations and repairs, which are a bit of a headache. And also, if you're buying into older buildings and the area is popular enough, there's going to be ebbs and flows of new condos being built in the area. Whenever that happens, that creates a lot of pressure on the older building owners. And there's a bit of a race to the bottom kind of thing with the rent where, you know, people can see, well, you know, if I pay Niman extra per month, I'm going to get a brand new unit. Why would I get this old thing? And then there's suddenly 12 vacancies in your condo building and everyone's trying to put the price lower and lower to get the tenants as quickly as possible. So the yield tends to be a lot less stable when you're buying a lower quality property.
Okay.
If you wanted to get that sort of the higher end of that range, do people or your clients take out a home loan to do that, an investment loan, or are they generally people that would just buy it in cash?
A small percentage of our Japan resident clients do. There are also a couple of options for non-residents. There's a bank in Singapore that does strictly condo units, investment properties. And Shinsei Investment and Finance, which is a subsidiary of Shinsei Bank, also do a non-resident loan, but they will force you to set up a company in Japan. And companies in Japan, as you two probably know, come with $3,000-$4,000 a year in annual corporate upkeep. So if you're not going to be buying a small building, let's say for $500,000-$600,000, it's probably not worth it to set up a company just for a few small units. Mm-hmm. I think Oryx in Hong Kong, Star Bank in Taiwan, who also have a presence in Tokyo, and Bank of China, they provide similar products, but the terms are not nearly as attractive as a native Japanese investment loan.
So you don't get people who get one property and then get a loan on that and get another one sort of?
That drawing on the equity thing again doesn't happen here. Yeah. You can't do that.
No, not at all. No.
If you built up a rental income portfolio and you're increasing your income little by little, then you could borrow on that.
Ah, right. Okay.
But based on the income, not the value of the building.
Not the value of the asset, yes.
Interesting.
So all those books from America on real estate investing out the window.
Yeah. Invest with other people's money. Yeah. Leverage your asset. No.
Yeah, I bought 30 buildings in 2 years.
I know, a lot of them do. And you know, it's a strategy that can work unless, you know, there's a sudden economic downturn, but let's not get into that. But if depending on your budget, we've mentioned 500, 600,000 in case you want to set up a company, but there are definitely still small buildings in relatively good locations in Japan that our customers regularly buy that start at about 35 million yen, right? So you could buy a four-unit aparto, like two floors, two units in each floor, or a little bit over that if you increase your budget a little bit, maybe up to 8 or 12 units, that you could buy for, especially with the current US to Japanese yen rate or whatever other currency you're dealing in. If you're bringing money from overseas, it's even cheaper. And then you also own a larger land plot, which is the only thing that can appreciate in Japan. And you have the flexibility, which you don't have in a condo unit, to do with the property as you please within local municipality regulations. So you can definitely easily rent out rooms by the month. You can decide that you're allowing commercial tenants in there. You can, if you're qualifying and complying with local municipality regulations, you could try Airbnb. Down the track, if the property is not as profitable as you thought, you can raise it and set up a logistics warehouse facility, or whatever you want. You have the flexibility to do with the property as you wish, and you have more growth potential because you own the entire land plot, not just a fraction of it like you do with a condo unit.
Right. How easy is it to rezone? Like, is that necessary? If you knock down your apartment building, can you build a huge house on the plot? Or
huge? No. So usually zoning regulations become stricter over time, not more lenient. So if you've purchased something within the last 5 or 6 years, zoning regulations most likely have not changed that much. But if it's something that was built 20 or 30 years ago, there's always almost going to be need for you to at least set back when you rebuild. So you will actually build a smaller structure. But if you had a house, for example, that covered a large portion of that land, you could potentially build a 2-3 floor unit aparto on it and that would increase your rental income, right?
So
depending on what you bought and how big the land plot is and what the current zoning regulations are.
Now, if you've attended any of our recent JREP Summit events in Tokyo, you've probably heard our sponsor, Robert Miller from Innovatius.com. He's been in web solutions here in Japan for the past 25 years, and he's also an active investor in Japanese real estate property, as well as global online property, which is his specialty and what his company Innovatius is all about. They offer a full suite of website services for entrepreneurs and small business owners, including all aspects of web design and management, backup and updates, content formatting and editing, proactive maintenance and error fixing, you name it, with a strong focus on SEO excellence, which is what gets you those hardcore top-of-the-list search engine rankings. But there is a difference. Innovatius works off a simple, all-inclusive monthly subscription model, as opposed to the typical outdated and confusing per-project model. So you never have to wonder how much any request for any work to be done on your website might cost. It's always $297 per month. Period. And if that's not enough, if you mention that you've heard of their services on the Japan Real Estate Podcast, you'll also get 10% off this monthly price for life. Also, and equally important, if not more, you can try out Innovatius for just 1 month, then switch them off, on again later if you wish, and so forth. There are no minimum subscription terms. Now, if you're a small business owner, managing and growing a website is super distracting and time-consuming, right? That's exactly where Innovatius comes in. Robert's team takes care of all of that for you so that you can focus on what you do best. So feel free to email Rob at robert@innovatius.com. That's INNOVACIOUS.com. And his team will conduct a full SEO and website audit on your site, reveal anything that you should address to lift your website's appeal and visitor numbers, and provide you with an easy-to-read, detailed report with your own branding so that you can make some informed decisions on your online strategy and watch your business grow as you implement it. So once more, robert@innovatius.com. Drop him a line and get your website reviewed today.
Awesome. So you mentioned people dying. Is it as bad as the rumors say? If your tenant dies, do you have to like burn the building down? And
No. First of all, there's a huge difference between a natural death and a suicide or murder. I haven't had any murder properties. We have helped the customer buy one suicide property, but most of the cases that we have, and it's a lot more common than you think, I'd say about 5 or 6% of our tenants die in their properties just because they're old. And they're usually, especially with the one-bedroom studio type units, they're destitute pensioners who are not really in touch with their children, if they have any children, or, you know, a child or a sister might come and check on them once a year kind of thing. So often they simply die in the property. That particularly is not such a huge stigma. Recently, actually, a legislation was passed which finally made that distinction between murder, suicide versus natural death. So natural death these days, you don't need to report to the next buyer or the next tenant in line. That's not to say that they're not going to find out, because there are plenty of websites that advertise that. And also the agents, being Japanese, are feeling a bit uncomfortable not to disclose that, regardless of the laws. And we also feel it's a fair thing to let people know that this is what happened. You'll find it a bit more challenging to rent at the same rental income a couple of years down the track, or the next tenant in line, let's say. It becomes a lot easier after one's moved in and then moved out again. Murder, suicide would be a lot more challenging. That definitely carries a stigma, not just for Japanese, but for all Asians. We haven't dealt with those properties. But the important part is that if you're buying a tenanted property, or you're buying an investment property that you're planning to tenant, you just get landlord insurance. That's like a basic, basic thing. It's going to cost you peanuts, like 5,000-6,000 yen a year. And that covers you for up to about 1,000,000 yen in renovations and repairs after the death, which is important because there's all kinds of special cleaning and Buddhist purification ceremonies that need to be done. But far more importantly, it covers you for up to, depending on your policy and how friendly you are with your insurance agent and how much work you've given him, but between a year to 2 years of reduced or non-existent rental income. So the insurance company will pay you for a period. In our case, it's up to 2 years, but I think that's probably because we've got hundreds of properties that we've insured with the same company. So we'll probably get better terms, but definitely up to a year of missing rental income while you struggle to find tenants at the same level of rental income. And then towards the end of that compensation period, you just advertise it for a really low rent for the next tenant in line, maybe try to make it a fixed term lease instead of a long-term lease. The people who are looking for these super, super, super cheap rentals are probably going to agree to a fixed lease as well. And then once they've concluded their tenancy, you just go back to normal.
Ah, right.
Okay. You mentioned landlord insurance there, and this ties in, I think, with the question earlier about costs. So landlord insurance sounds like that's not very much, but also there would be on any property earthquake insurance, I think, isn't it? So
yes, they call it earthquake. They call it fire insurance, but it covers a bunch of natural disasters.
Right. And then if it's in a mansion, aparto, it would be a management fee and a building maintenance fee as well, I guess. If you're renting it out, it would be a management fee. And then
management fee and reserve funds contribution. Yes.
Right. And then property tax. And then if you're making a profit, you would pay income tax. Is that...
Depending on your portfolio, if you've got an accountant who knows what they're doing, you're probably not going to pay much income tax. Again, back to our conversation previously, you might be able to reduce your income tax.
Right. Are there any other
taxes? On the rental cash cows, which tend to be not more than 3 bedrooms, slightly older buildings, let's say, that usually boils up to not more than 40,000-50,000 yen a year.
Yeah, ours is about
that. And the building fees you would factor into your yield calculations from the get-go, right? So if you know the rental income is Goman or Juman or whatever the case may be, you deduct the building fees from that. You deduct the property management fee, which is usually 5% plus tax, so 5.5%. And then you arrive at your bottom line yield and you evaluate that before you pull the trigger on the purchase. It's not going to be a surprise. You're going to know all of that information.
Yeah, property management fee, only about 5%. That's much less than I thought.
No, I mean, we get 3-4% because we work with the same property managers and we give them a bunch of properties to manage. But the industry standard is usually 5%.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Actually, in Shikoku, for some reason, maybe because there's not that many property managers, they are actually feeling very justified to charge 8 and 10%, which is why we don't do much business there.
Right. Yeah, I thought 10% was the norm, but okay, well, that's a pleasant surprise.
No, 5%. I mean, if you go to some of the companies that flout the fact that they've got national branches all over the country, franchises, and they say, well, yes, you know, we charge 10% because we give you nationwide coverage, but it's honestly nonsense because each office is completely different to all the other offices. There's absolutely no advantage with them being in a nationwide spread. Mm-hmm. So you just want to work with a local company that charges normally 5%.
Oh, okay.
Interesting. So, and you charge a fee as well, presumably.
If somebody needs us to manage the portfolio or manage the managers, so to speak, on their behalf, then we charge a minimum fee of 3,000 yen per month if they purchase the property through us, or 4,000 if they purchase it elsewhere. And for that, we will be the contact person for the property manager, the building management company, insurance company, renovation, repair, whatever. We charge other fees upon vacancies. We charge half a month upon repopulating the property. If we have to do any non-routine work, like submit insurance claims or apply to court in case of, for example, an absconding tenant, then you have to get a one-sided termination order from the court. So those kind of things we just charge by the hour, but basically it's one monthly hour. If you're buying a property that generates beyond a certain amount, we just charge 2%.
Mm, okay.
So worst case, it comes up to 7%, 5% for the property manager, 2% for us.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then that would that come out of the yield, or you would calculate that?
We present, I can share a screen if you want me to, but we basically give our customers spreadsheets that factor all of that into it. And the net pre-tax yield that they see at the bottom is what the property is actually going to be yielding per year on purchase. As it gets older, building fees goes up. What we've discussed earlier, if there's going to be extra demand in the area, you might have to reduce the rent a little bit. Japan being Japan, salaries haven't gone up much in the last 20 or what years. So you're not going to be raising the rent in the vast majority of cases. So what tends to happen over time is as the building ages, you're going to be reducing your yield, not increasing it. Mm. There's no rent hikes. So we normally recommend to our customers, as a building approaches about 40 years of age, is when building fees start to escalate a bit more quickly because it requires more frequent maintenance and renovations. We recommend to people to buy them not older than 30 years on purchase. And then as they approach about 40 years, start considering reselling them and recycling the money into something newer, which also will kick off your purchase costs and management costs deduction claims again, because you can only do that for 3 years or 5 years, I think, as a company.
Oh, right.
Okay. So I just need to get a high income now to make this to make this worth it.
Cover Retire Japan with ads.
Cool. I heard you officially retired, Ben. Is that right?
I lost my job.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like officially retiring.
Yeah, so yeah, I don't have formal employment anymore. So
yeah, you don't seem too concerned though. That's good.
No. That's the point. That was the whole point of this whole thing.
Yeah.
So
no, you're living proof of the entire doctrine. Yeah.
Yeah, 2008, I lost my job. It was a horrible experience. So I made sure the next time I lost my job, it was okay.
Yeah.
Cool. I think we've got a couple of questions, and then we'll let Ziv go, because otherwise we'll be here all night.
Should we try and go through these quickly then?
Quick general one about property prices in Japan going down. Any thoughts, Ziv?
Yep. So what we've seen since we've started doing this, and I think we've got at least a couple of decades more of this happening, is that the population drop in Japan needs to be granulated a bit more into individual locations. Because if you actually look at the numbers in the population census, what happens is all of those smaller townships and villages that are dying out are conglomerating into the bigger metropolitan centers in their respective areas. And then what we're getting is that the population in most of the large cities in Japan is actually constantly rising, right? You have a few years where Sapporo goes stagnant and then starts rising again. Kumamoto goes stagnant. It's not even such a big city, but, you know, and somebody builds a factory and then people from the little villages. So the big metropolitan centers are actually drawing the population from the countryside. And that's been the case, again, at least since we've been in business, which is when I started following these trends. I don't see, with 120 or now 110 million people in Japan, I don't see that trend reversing for at least another 20 years until everything empties out into the major metropolitan centers. I make a long-term plan for 20 years, but I don't presume to know what will happen geoeconomically, politically, in any particular country or region over the course of 2 decades. So I'm guessing that Japan will enact some policies to increase immigration or encourage a better birth rate at some stage when they notice that things are getting very serious. But in any case, I don't project 20 years ahead. For the next 20 years, I can definitely see population in big metropolitan centers continuing to grow or at least remain stable. So that's as far as I think about it.
Okay, so basically choose where you buy your properties. Like, don't just buy random Akiya in the forest.
I mean, the first thing that we check about any potential investment location is what's happening with the population. I'm not saying don't look at it. I'm saying look at it granularly, not on a national level.
Yeah.
In the chat, I just put a website, ecitizen.jp. Maybe you that recommended that originally, I can't remember. But this shows the population change per prefecture in Japan. And I went through it a while ago and was surprised how different it is, depending on where you look.
Cool. And then a bit of a case study for you, Ziv.
Yep. Just opened a franchise store in Japan. Awesome. That's my other business. We haven't talked about it. We do that another time. And we help people invest in those too. And I want to try something in real estate next. What would be Ziv's recommendation of things to look at if you have 150, 200K? I think that's really hard to make recommendations on without knowing what the person is interested in doing. So do you want to be hands-on? Do you want to be passive? Are you the DIY type? Are you just looking for turnkey, set and forget rental income? Or are you okay living with a bit more uncertainty for the first year while you, like Ben was saying, tweak a property or try to buy it cheap and then renovate it. I mean, there are a gazillion options that that budget would enable you to do, barring buildings. I mean, buildings in good locations would cost more than that. Not much more than that, but more than that. But houses and condo units are both very valid options. So the question is, do you have the mental bandwidth and do you have the time on your hands to deal with doing something a bit more creative? If not, I would say buy one or potentially two mansion units, condo units in reasonably good locations, barring central Tokyo, central Osaka, where yields are paltry. And just collect passive, not, I don't like to call anything passive income, but collect relatively passive rental income from a long-term tenant. If you want to invest the entire sum into one property, you could potentially get a good, well-located commercial property, like a shop at the bottom of a condo building, for example. And those are the only places where you can potentially raise the rent if the business and the economy do well. It's really a matter of how creative and hands-on you want to be. If you, you know, if you got the time on your hands and the inclination and you're that type of person, then buying a house in the countryside and turning it into an attractive accommodation property or renting it out to families and coming in person to fix stuff when it doesn't work, then those are all options that could potentially get you higher yield. But again, they require more a hands-on approach.
Brilliant. And then the last question is this. It's like, it's almost like we planted it.
Yes. So the Japan real estate or YouTube/Japan_real_estate. That's our YouTube channel. The Japan real estate group on Facebook and the Japan real estate Facebook page is where we publish other stuff. Most of our customers tend to, most of our followers tend to like mostly the Japan real estate podcast. There's only one of us. So if you Google or in your iTunes store or anywhere online, if you just search for Japan real estate podcasts, we're the only one out there and we've been at it for a while.
Awesome. So yeah, thank you so much, Ziv. This has been really interesting. We'll have to get you on again to talk about your franchise business.
Anytime.
But we'll leave that for next time. So yeah, thanks a lot.
Great being with you again. Talk to you soon. And,
thank you, Ziv.
Yeah, see you again soon. Bye. Cool.
Interesting as always. And apologies to people. Very good.
I'm almost to tempted to go through Ziv and buy a little mansion somewhere. But I think I do think personally I would need to have a higher income to make that attractive.
Right. Yeah.
Because right now I don't really have any income. So.
Yeah.
I'd be missing out on like half of the value of owning physical real estate, I think.
Right. Yeah.
But you could do it. And then we could do a little mini YouTube series about Daniel's real estate adventure.
It's very tempting. I'd have to sell some shares, which I'm always reluctant to do. But I don't have quite as much money thrown around as some of his higher end clients that he mentioned. But
yeah.
It's tempting.
So yes, huge thanks again to Ben and Daniel for inviting me to speak with them. Always a pleasure chatting with financially savvy folks like these two, since even though we may have different strategies, we're definitely on the same page as far as the need for investment, savings, and financial planning is concerned. I've really enjoyed our conversation. Hope you did as well. Now, before we go, we're also, as always, going to tell you and also link to our other sponsor's website. That's Hiroshi Shimizu, immigration lawyer and administrative scrivener. If you're thinking about moving here on a more permanent basis, or you're already in Japan on some sort of a temporary visa and you want to switch to a longer term or permanent one, or if you're considering setting up a local company or a branch office of a foreign company and you've got any sort of business or visa related inquiries, or even if you just want to find out what your options are on any of these topics, feel free to contact Hiroshi Shimizu. You can find him at japanimmigrationexperts.com. And he can help you set up a company, apply for any kind of visa, or just provide you with the best advice and extremely affordable consultation related to these topics. And he's already done that for many of our listeners. So feel free to reach out to him. Again, that's japanimmigrationexperts.com, and you'll be well on your way. And that's it from us for today, folks. Hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Japan Real Estate Podcast. Do share it with your networks and please let us know what you think. So leave us a short rating or review on the iTunes store, on Spotify, or just drop us a line in the comment section of wherever you might have found this episode. We love hearing from you. Hope to have you with us again next time, and until then, have a great day or night ahead. Yoroshiku.